Good morning. Well, we've got a full house this morning. Good to see everyone. So today I'm going to talk about doing rounds, which is sometimes referred to as doing morning rounds. When I say that, how many of you know what I'm talking about here at MZMC, doing rounds? Quite a few, but a lot of you don't. So I'm going to explain what that is. And morning rounds is something that is done at most Zen centers, I think, maybe just about all Zen centers. I really don't know. But it happens when a priest visits various altars first thing in the morning and does some bows. That happens here during the weekday, Monday through Thursday, early in the morning, and also on Saturday. And also during sesshins, which are formal retreats. And so if you've done one of those things, you know a little bit about what rounds are about. But even if you've been here then, you may not know fully what's going on, because you'll be facing the wall. Because in the morning, we have a different setup here. We have zafus and zabutons, these things, all around the perimeter of the zendo and also the founder's hall. So you may hear some rustling around by the priest as you're sitting, and you're facing the wall, and you may be aware of someone walking behind you at one point, but you probably don't know the full extent of what goes on, so I'm going to tell you, and I think it's really quite beautiful, and I'd just like to share that with you. And also, because only certain people can do rounds, you have to be a transmitted priest, and it's a little mysterious also, it kind of gives me an opportunity to reflect a little bit on roles here at Zen Center, and who gets to do what, and specifically a new role that I'm going to be stepping into on January 1st. So rounds may be done by any of the transmitted teachers, and here that's Tim, Rosemary, Susan, Guy, Ben, Busho, Wanda, or me. And these are priests who have permission to teach independently, and when they do rounds, they're in the role of doshi. And on days when I do rounds, and that's usually Wednesday morning or during a sesshin that I'm leading, I live in St. Paul, so I set my alarm for 4:20 a.m. because I have a bit of a drive. And that gives me just enough time to have a cup of coffee and a little breakfast and take a shower, and I get out the door of my house at 5:05 a.m. I have this down to a science. There's very little traffic at 5:05 a.m., which is nice. So I make my way to St. Clair Avenue, and I go east for a block, and then I go north on Lexington. I get to I-94. I cross the Mississippi River. I see downtown Minneapolis looming there, and I always take a look at it. You know, monks in Tibet, they have their huge mountains that make them think how small they are and how they fit into the great cosmos, and forest monks in Thailand have their forest. And we have these massive buildings. And if you look at them, your feelings toward them may be quite complex. It may not be the same as a mountain to you, but they really are kind of awe-inspiring. And they're always changing, always. Depending on the light and the weather, they just always look different. So the river, when I cross the river, I'm always conscious of that. And that river connects me to the rest of the country, I think, everything upstream and downstream. And those buildings remind me of my smallness in this great, modern, complex, difficult world. So then I drive down Hennepin, and I get here at about 5:30. And sometimes I unlock the door. Sometimes the Doan is here already and has unlocked the door already. And I go downstairs to the changing room, and I put on my robes. I'm not wearing my robes now. We don't do that on Sundays, but in the morning we put on robes, and they're kind of big, and they're complicated. There are four layers, and there are a couple of belts, and the top layer is the okeza, which is brown, and it looks kind of like this rakasu that I'm wearing, except it's really big enough that I can wrap it around my shoulders. And the okaza is something that we sew ourselves, and it needs to be tied just so. So I put on all of this, and I go up to Tim's office. And I'll visit five altars during rounds, and Tim's is the first one of those. So I wait for the signal, and the signal is the Han, which is the wooden block at the top of the stairs. At 5:40, it gets hit twice to let everyone know that it's time to make their way into the Zendo. And at 5:45, it gets hit once. And that means it's time to be in the Zendo, time to be settled on your cushion, and it's time for me to begin rounds. So I turn to the altar, and if I haven't done it already, I light the candle, and I do three standing bows at the altar. And as I talk about these five altars, I'm going to talk a little bit about what these altars symbolize, what they symbolize for me, and how they connect me, connect us with other things in our world beyond our immediate situation. And talking about these things is kind of like invoking all beings throughout time and space, and bringing them here this morning into this space, bringing them into our awareness. And I'm not saying that I think about all of these things as I do rounds in the morning. I mean, I try not to do a lot of thinking during rounds. I'm supposed to just be here. But I do think that these various altars help to remind me of all of these connections, and I'm kind of holding them in my mind wordlessly as I make rounds. All of the connections I have outside of myself, all of the connections we have here at MZMC within, you know, connections with each other, and our connections to the wide world. And I think that's the purpose of rounds, to acknowledge at the very beginning of the day the great universe and all the beings in it, and to remember our place, our tiny, vital, important place in this great web of thusness, and to remember how important it is to act in such a way that all of that is taken into account, because nothing is excluded from our practice. So on Tim's altar, there are statues of Shakyamuni Buddha and statues of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, and some other things, some turtles. There's a snail. But the statues of Shakyamuni Buddha in particular make me think of links to our teachers and to our tradition. And they remind me that we would not be here today, we could not be enjoying this practice, we would not have this community if it were not for those thousands of years of people preserving traditions and doing the practice. There were the teachers before the Buddha, long before the Buddha, who created this rich milieu that he came out of. And there was the Buddha himself. And there were all of his successors. And there were the women ancestors whose names have been left unsung. There were teachers in India and China and Japan and finally this country. There was Katagiri Roshi, who founded this center. And there was Karen Suna, who succeeded him. And there was Tim, who succeeded her. This is an awesome lineage, and we should never forget the sacrifices they've made and the things that they've done in order to preserve this practice for us. And also we should never forget the transmitted priests that we have here, all of whom were ordained by Tim, as well as all of the priests in training, and what valuable services to the community they perform. So in bowing at Tim's altar, I am bowing to all of these teachers, and three standing bows is not enough, but in my mind, infinite bows, continuous bows. So I make my three bows, and I put out the candle, and I leave Tim's office, and I come down that back stairs that we have there, past the Han, and into the kitchen. And there I find the second altar, And that's a little altar. If you've been in the kitchen, maybe you noticed it, maybe you didn't. But it's sort of to the left of the fridge by one of the doors that leads out of the kitchen. And it has a fancy backboard carved of wood, which is very nice, and it's got a little projecting shelf, and it has some flowers there, and a candle, and a fan for putting out the candle, and a small statue of the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, I think this time in the form of Kuan Yin. And what this altar links me to, you could say, is, well, this is the realm of the Tenzo in the kitchen. The Tenzo is our cook. And during Sesshin, the Tenzo and the assistant Tenzo work very hard and very mindfully to cook for the entire assembly. This past Rohatsu, which was just a week ago, we started with 17 people and it gradually increased to, I think, over 40 on Saturday. So I think that's something like 550 meals. And while we have our own service here in the Zendo during Sesshin in the morning, the Tenzo and some other folks are having their own service in the kitchen. And the Tenzo does 9 bows at that little altar. And so this makes me think not just of the Tenzo, but of all the volunteers we have here at Zen Center and the entire Sangha. And again, we would not be here without all of these volunteers. It takes an amazing amount of stuff to keep this place running, a lot of work, a lot of commitment. And it takes everyone in the Sangha to hold it up and attend things and support this place. And we have a chart called Who Does What at MZMC. I think it's posted in the kitchen. And I counted 103 names on there. And some people have multiple roles, so maybe it's not 103 people. Maybe it's 80 people. I don't know. But still, that's a lot of people. We have the Eno, we have the tea cooks, we have the flower crew, we have the board members, and way more people than I would ever have time to mention. And all of these roles are vital. Zen Center is a web of interconnections, and it has the highest ideals, and it exists in a crowded space. And when any kind of change occurs, we need to respect these interconnections and consider them. That's very, very important. So the candle at the kitchen altar will already have been lit by the Doan. And I do 3 standing bows at that altar. And then I put the candle out. Again, 3 bows is not enough. Then I step to my left and I look through 2 doorways and I see the Doan standing there. And we bow together. And I turn to my right and I go down the steps to the basement altar. And you may have noticed that we have an altar just outside of our bathrooms. You may have bowed to it many, many times. So it's an interesting thing, I think, in Zen centers that we place an altar outside the bathrooms. The idea is that before you go in, you bow to the altar, and when you come out, you bow to the altar again. And it's not required, but it's a nice thing to do. And I think it's easy to think maybe that some activities in our life don't really matter, or maybe they're impure in some way, or they're defiled, or maybe they can be excluded from our mindful approach to life somehow. But that's not really true of any of our activities. And we have that altar there to remind us of the importance of mindfulness in every phase of our life. And that altar is pretty plain. It's not fancy like the kitchen altar, but it's beautiful nonetheless. It has a backboard and a little projecting shelf. And under that shelf are 2 little kind of wooden boxes for people to place their rakasus like this or their okazas while they're in the bathroom. And there's a little vase of flowers and a candle and a fan for putting out the candle flame. And instead of a statue, there's a picture down there. And it's a picture of a Buddha figure on an altar with a rough wood wall in the background. It looks like aged barn wood, which it is. And I don't know who chose that picture or why, but I do recognize that Buddha. That's the altar in the Zendo at Sonoma Mountain Zen Center in California, where I once did a practice period, and where the Zendo is in what used to be a barn of some kind. So that altar links me to a couple of things. The importance of mindfulness in daily life, in all of our activities, but also because of that picture from Sonoma, it links me to other Zen centers and other Zen practitioners throughout the country and the world, and Buddhist practitioners of all kinds throughout the world. So this includes our sister centers here in the Twin Cities, Compassionate Ocean, Dharma Field, and Clouds and Water. It includes Hokyoji in southeastern Minnesota, Mountains and Waters Alliance down in Northfield, and beyond, centers beyond Minnesota, all the individual practitioners who don't have a center, and all the folks who listen to our talks online and have a connection to us. You folks online are a very important part of our Sangha. We don't know how many folks listen, but we hear things from time to time, and we think they are quite a few. And thank you very much for listening. And let's not stop with Buddhists. We're linked to all beings throughout space and time. So, three standing bows to all of these beings. I hope to hold them in my heart constantly. So I put out the candle, and I climb back up the stairs, and I turn to my right, and there's the Doan again, a little closer this time. And we bow to each other, and I walk forward, and I turn to the right, and I bow at the entrance to the Founders Hall, this room over here. And this is where we have the altar dedicated to Katagiri, the founder of our center. I walk up to the altar. I make a little bow. I take out my zagu from under my sleeve. That's my bowing cloth. My zagu was sewn by Rosemary and given to me by her. So that connects me with our sewing tradition, which is such a valuable part of our practice. And I put the zagu down on the bowing mat, just so, and I do three full prostrations in front of this altar. And I cannot help but have complex feelings when I bow at Katagiri's altar, or when I talk about it now. We wouldn't be here without Katagiri. Katagiri was very, very kind, and he gave an awful lot, an incalculable amount, so that we could be here. And he was a great teacher. And I can never hope to be even a small fraction of the great teacher that Katagiri was. I came here after Katagiri's death, and so I never met him. But for years I've been plying people with questions about him and doing everything I can to get to know him. And I have to say that his influence has been vital and basic to my practice, and that I love him. And I still feel his presence very strongly here at MZMC. And you can love someone and still know that they weren't a human, a perfect human being. And I'm aware that Katagiri was a flawed human being, that it came out after his death that he had had improper sexual relationships with students. That's difficult to talk about. And I know that it's still painful, especially to people who knew him. But we have to mention it from time to time. We have to be open and honest about it, because we have to make sure that nothing like that ever happens again. And we don't hide it. It's there in Katagiri's biography on our website. We have a prominent statement about it under the Ethical Conduct and Precepts tab. We talk about it from time to time. We have ethics policies in place now. We train our priests extensively about boundaries. And folks in leadership are very, very aware about the importance of respecting these boundaries. We talk about power, and we talk about misuse of power. So we study that in all kinds of contexts. And this, too, is part of the fabric of our center. And it doesn't define us, but it must be acknowledged. So that's there. When I make my rounds, it's all there. And after my three bows, I fold up my zagu again, and I put it under my sleeve, and I leave the candle burning, And I make a little bow, and I turn around, and I walk to the zendo, to this room, and bow at the entrance. And I walk up to this altar right here, so there's a bowing mat here, which is kind of thick, right where I'm sitting. And I put down my zagu again, and I do three bows here. And on this altar, as you can see, we have Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who cuts through delusion. Sometimes he's pictured with a sword to cut through your delusion by saying, no, not that, no, not that, whatever you think it is, it's not that. And then you go, oh, whatever I think it is, it's not that. And he says, it's not that either. So he keeps us open. He dwells in a place where there are no expectations or concepts, and he finds freedom there, and he can do anything, no matter how hard it gets. And that's why he's seated peacefully on a tiger. And this is kind of an ideal based on emptiness, but of course it must be balanced by our presence in the world of form as well. So to me, this altar means a couple of things. Because it's Manjushri, it makes me think of the heart of Zen. No, not that. No, not that either. Zen is about continuous openness to things as it is, and about not making a thing out of anything, about continually challenging what you believe. That's the heart of Zen, and that's what we preserve, that heart. Rituals may change, trappings may change, Zen changes as it moves from one culture to another. But the heart of Zen must always be that sword that cuts through delusion. Or if that sword image seems a little harsh, just think of Manjushri sitting there on the tiger, letting it all go each moment free. So the heart of Zen, that's why we're here. That's why we're here. Another thing about this altar is that this is where we sometimes put name cards and pictures of people who have passed on. No one there right now, fortunately. You may have seen these. We leave them on the altar for 49 days. Perhaps someone you know has been up there. Perhaps your mom, perhaps your dad. My mom and my dad have both been up there. A student of mine has been up there. This makes me think of the pastoral care aspect of what we do and of the deep bond we form when we are together and supporting each other during the most difficult parts of our lives. So after my three bows here, I again take up my zagu, and I make another little bow. And when I make that little bow here, I leave my hands together like this, and I begin to walk around the perimeter of the zendo very slowly and very quietly, and through that doorway and around the perimeter of the Founders Hall and back in here. If it's a weekday, there might be only a few people here. There might be 3 or 6 or 9 people here. If it's a Shishin, there could be as many as 40 people in these two rooms. And the idea is, and you may not know this, even if you've sat here during those times, is that when the teacher walks behind you and he or she is holding their hands like this, when you hear the teacher approaching, you raise your hands like this in greeting in the same way. And then when the teacher passes, you put your hands down again. There's really no need to kind of look and watch for the teacher. You can see the teacher and hear the teacher. You can look out of the corner of your eye. And it's a nice moment when this happens. I really like that greeting. And it's a greeting. It's not the person meditating bowing down to the teacher. Sometimes I'm in the doshi role, and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm here just sitting. And I like to make this greeting to the teacher. Hi, thanks for being here this morning. But still, there's something about this part of rounds that makes me reflect a bit on the relationships we create when we have a hierarchical structure, when we have leaders in our community. And most organizations have leaders, and I think all Zen centers do, and there are good reasons for that, but it's good to recognize that it's there. So this greeting I just learned is called kenton, and it literally means looking at the ton. And the ton is the assigned sitting place for a monk, so it's your zafu and zabuton. So one source says kenton is a formal checking of the monks, and another says that in doing kenton, the master gets an impression of the state of mind of the practitioners. So I like to think of it as a greeting, but there's a little element of it, at least historically, of kind of, I'm checking up on you. And when I'm walking this way, I'm standing, you're sitting, I can see you and you can't see me. And then there's the fact that not everyone can be doshi. And I think there are good reasons that not everyone can be in that role, why we don't take turns. For a teacher to get transmission in order to be in that role, it's a minimum, I'd say, including Zen initiation and preparing for it, of a 10-year process, 10 years of training. And it's some very rigorous training. And that's a way of ensuring that the tradition is respected and not diluted. When you see a brown robe, you can know that that person has been fully trained, has been through an incredible amount of stuff, and has a great deal of experience. But still, there is that power differential. There are these layers of hierarchy. And that is something I'm quite aware of as I prepare to take on a new role at Zen Center myself. In January, as many of you know, I'll go from being assistant guiding teacher to being co-guiding teacher with Tim. And things are probably not going to look a lot different when that happens, and you may not even notice it, because I've been kind of easing into this role for a few years now. But I think I'd be remiss if I did not reflect on, if I may say it, the profound nature of this position. And I've been thinking for some time about whether I should even mention this transition in a Dharma talk. And a big part of me said no, because I don't want to bring attention to myself. I don't want to make this about me. I don't want to crow. I don't want to come off as arrogant talking about this big thing that I'm going to do. But I thought again. I think one way that power gets misused is when people don't admit that they have it. And when I hear people say something like, wow, you have a really powerful position here. This is a really big deal. Part of me wants to say, oh, come on, it's just me. It's Ted. You know me. I'm really nice, and it's no big deal, and nothing's changing, and don't worry. But that's not really true. I'll be making decisions with Tim that will have a big effect on other people, and I can't pretend otherwise. So I want to talk about it. I want to acknowledge it. I want to acknowledge that this is a serious role. It's just a role. Sometimes I'm in this role. Sometimes I'm in other roles. If I show up for work practice, my role is worker, and I'm under the direction of the work leader. But still, there is this role. This is category's seat here, and somehow I'm in it. I think that this transition is going to be good for the community. I think that Tim was being very forward-looking and very generous in saying that he wanted a co-guiding teacher to share his role. That helps, I think, to make a smooth transition. I think it's good to have a second opinion on things. As for his choice of me to do this, I'm honored by that. I'm honored by the board's confidence in me. I'm aware that my relationships with some folks, some of my peers, may change a little bit. And I'm sorry, and I just want to say to my peers that I love you, and I will always listen to you, and I hope to never lose my human connection with you. I approach this job with a lot of joy. I love what I do. I love teaching, and I even love the administrative part. I even love going to meetings, and I go to a lot of meetings. But I get to work with a lot of wonderful people. I also approach this job with some trepidation. It's not easy. I know that much already, and I'm not even in it yet. The responsibility is really great. And I'm a sensitive person, and I know that people will sometimes be unhappy with me. And that's hard for me, but it's my task to learn to deal with that. And leadership is a tricky thing. You need to lead, but you also need to be led. Especially with our understanding of interconnectedness. It's just vital that I remember that leading is really serving. Serving everything in that great web of interconnectedness. Keeping in mind at all times that that web is there. Finding out what it is that this web needs to do and helping that to happen. As in meditation practice, I need to give up my own ego, the filter of my own desires. And as with our practice, I need to act in the world, guided by right thinking and right action and the Bodhisattva ideal. And thus, I need to remember at all times that what I'm doing here is serving those things that those five altars remind me of. The Buddhas and ancestors, the teachers here, all the volunteers at Zen Center and the community. I must remember the importance of mindfulness in all aspects of daily life. No part is excluded. I must remember other Zen Centers and the worldwide community of Buddhists and all beings throughout space and time and our neighbors and the community, the history of this center, the importance of ethical conduct, the heart of Zen practice, which must never be diluted, no matter how much we grow. And I must remember how we support each other through difficult times when we put those pictures on the altar. And I must carry all of this with me so that leadership is in service to all of that. And that means really listening and taking into account everyone's needs. And I know that sometimes I make mistakes in that regard. I've not always listened to everyone as I should before making a decision. But I know I've learned from that, and I hope to do a much better job in the future. And I ask for your forgiveness for the mistakes I've made, and that you give me a chance, and that you understand that I'm going to have quite a learning curve here, and I'm going to need your support. Or I can't do this. So if leadership is service to all of these things, that's good. But you know, even that is not enough. That's an ideal. It's an ideal to say that I will always keep these things in mind so that I will always lead fairly and not make mistakes. But of course, we have to think about what are our institutional guarantees that that's going to happen. We can't just sort of rely on my good intentions. And also we have to remember that it's a two-way street. And I ask you to please not put me or any teacher on a pedestal, and that you let me know what you're thinking, and you let me know what your needs are. You let me know if your needs are being met. I don't always know. Sometimes a teacher does something that's really not good for a student, and the student thinks, oh, that must be a teaching, and they don't say anything about it, when really it's just a stupid mistake on the part of the teacher. So talk to the teacher about it. It's okay. It's okay. You can do that, and you should do that. So when I do rounds, I'm greeting you, and you're greeting me, and it's very beautiful. And when I'm doing rounds, I'm going to do the best to hold all of these things in my heart, and I hope that you will as well, and that together we can successfully do this thing that we're doing that goes to the heart of Zen again and again, over and over, every day, for year after year. And that includes the practical aspects of how this center is run and what we do together. Let's, with open hearts, pursue this together in a conscious way. So on the first day of Rohatsu, I did rounds, and there were 16 people. And the last person I approached, I made my way all the way around, and I came to right here, and right here where Tanya's sitting, that's where Tim was sitting. And he was facing inwards with his hands in gassho, greeting me, which is kind of unusual. I'm not used to doing rounds and having Tim there greeting me, you know, because I was his student, you know. I started there, and here I am. Wow, I'm here now. And I had this urge to turn to him and do this special little gassho out of sort of respect and gratitude. And I could have. It would have been a little deviation from the forms, but doshis have a little leeway. They can do those kinds of things if they have a reason. But I didn't do it. And I think probably Tim wouldn't have wanted me to. And the reason for that is that it was my role that morning to be doshi. And that means to fully be doshi and to inhabit that role. And I think it's going to be the same with my role as co-guiding teacher. If I'm going to have that role, I'm going to fully inhabit it. And Tim has been generous in allowing me to do that. He's stepped back at the appropriate times to let me step forward. And I do intend to fully inhabit this role. I owe that to the Sangha, and I owe it to myself. So I'm going to continue to be my gentle self. I'm still going to be nice. And I'm going to do my very best to listen and consider everyone's needs. And I will also have difficult conversations when I need to. I'll deal with difficult issues when I need to. I'll do whatever needs to be done, no matter what it is. And I'll take ultimate responsibility. And I'll be firm in setting boundaries so that my health and my family life are preserved. And that's what I intend to do. And it feels good to talk about it. As you know, I wasn't going to talk about it. But that's what I do. I like to go to difficult places, and I like to open my heart. If something troubles me, if it makes me feel vulnerable, I like to go there and consider all aspects, and I like to talk about it. So there it is. There it is. And I so love doing this. I so love sharing the Dharma. I love talking to people who are brand new to it. I love those opportunities where we have for the really deep teaching, like on a long sesshin, or like when I have a one-on-one relationship with people that lasts months or years, and we just keep working on stuff. That's where I can do the really deep teaching, and I can say, yeah, you're on the right path there. Now, how about looking at this one particular thing, and holding this thing for a while, and seeing what that has to teach you, and seeing where that brings people. And I see hearts opening, and I see practice deepening, and I think I'm the luckiest person anywhere to get to do this work. So, after walking past the last person in the Zendo, I'm here again, and I do one standing bow, and simultaneously there's a bong on this big bell out here, because the Doan is watching carefully to synchronize with me. And then I walk over here to the place where I'll sit, and I face inward, and I bow, and there's a bong, and I turn around, and I face the assembly, and there's another bong. And I sit. And then the Doan comes in, and he or she sits right over there, and all beings throughout space and time are here sitting with us. And it's beautiful. And so that's the end. That's the end of my talk. So thank you so much for listening. And we have some time. If anyone has any comments or questions, I would welcome them. Yes?
What's the difference between this talk and the one upstairs?
Upstairs is the introduction. So upstairs we have, it's for folks who are new. It's okay to come down here if you're new to the center, but a lot of folks like to go up there because it kind of tells the basics of what Zen is all about, and it's a four-part series. You can jump in at any time. And there's meditation instruction during each of those. So, yeah. So the idea is maybe you attend those four and then you start coming down here, but you don't have to do it that way. Thanks. Yes, Pat. Thank you. Thank you. Yes?
How do you define a Dharma talk?
How do you define a Dharma talk? That's a good one. Some people might argue that some of my Dharma talks are not really Dharma talks. I don't know. Because, there's such a wide variety of things that they can be. Sometimes I tell stories from my life. Sometimes I talk about koans. Sometimes I do the kind of thing I did this morning, which is really kind of Sangha related. But I think all Dharma talks have to be, they have to be about Zen, you know. And ideally they're kind of a demonstration of Zen. They're not just talking about Zen, but they're showing what Zen is. So, yeah, Dharma talk, it's like a sermon. So it's a little different from a class. You know, a class may be meant to impart information, whereas a Dharma talk, I think, is really intended to go to the heart of what Zen is. Yes, Carrie.
I appreciate the visual, the doing rounds, because, like you said, when I've been facing the wall, I don't exactly know what's going on behind me.
Yes.
So I appreciate that. I also appreciate that. We pointed out the different altars, and I just visualized this web, you know, going, starting from, you know, upstairs, going, coming down, and going downstairs, and then coming up and around. It's like this this web that holds us all here in mm-hmm. this space, and bringing in all those different beings and all the different bodhisattvas, so that when you end up here, they are now all here. They have come kind of off their altars, and they are supporting us in our sitting practice. And I appreciate you and all the priests here and the priests in training who support me in my practice.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you feel supported, you feel held, and I think we all feel that from time to time. And it's such a beautiful thing to feel held by this community. You know, and I feel that all the time. I feel like I'm just kind of floating here, and so much is holding me up, and I feel such gratitude for that. Yes. Thank you. Roger.
I want to thank you for bringing up the complexity of our founder.
Mm-hmm. The complexity of our founder, yes.
Category.
Yes.
And I know that that's been an issue for some members, and I just appreciate your openness and honesty about that, and the fact that we can love someone who has human flaws.
Mm-hmm.
Not an excuse for the flaws, but a recognition of the contribution.
Yes. Yeah, well said. Thank you. Tanya.
So I never really thought about it until Rohatsu last week, that Manjushri is down here and the Buddha is upstairs. And then, by the way, last week we did a switch. So if you were here last week, it was Buddha up there. Why is Manjushri down here?
I think because this is Zen. And, you know, I think about original Buddhism and how some folks thought that it had gotten sort of ossified, that the trappings had sort of become more important than the essence of it, and that some people thought that the dharmas were real, that there were individual components of the universe that had this reality to them, that some things were sort of accepted from interconnectedness, and Mahayana Buddhism, of which Zen is a part, was a reaction to all of that. So it's like, wait a minute, hold it right there, is a big part of our tradition. And so in Zen centers, we often will have Manjushri rather than the Buddha.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So if you go to other traditions of Buddhism, they may have the Buddha, but Zen oftentimes is...
I think so. Yeah, and we have Buddha on numerous other altars, of course, as you know, and that's appropriate too. But this idea of continual challenge and continual renewal, you know, that's deep in our fabric, and I think that's why we're here, because we like being part of a religion which says the bizarre thing that if you see the founder of your religion coming down the road, kill him. That's pretty unusual, but hey, if you think it's a thing, no, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. That's what we do. Yes, Paul.
So I believe before Category died, wasn't the Founders Hall called the Buddha Hall? And the Buddha
Does anybody know? I'll bet it was, because that's kind of standard in Zen centers. You have this, and then you have a Buddha hall. So that makes sense. But probably we needed a space for a founder's hall. So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. And yes, Charlie.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were five altars. I always knew there was this one and then the one in the other room. And I really respected the two altars. And at times when you're having a cup of tea, I need to do something. I wanted to set my cup down someplace.
Yeah.
I want to respect that. I don't want to see. But I have noticed that at times somebody has set their cup on that altar.
Yeah.
How that works.
Yeah. I've seen that. Someone sets their teacup on the altar in the Founders Hall, and I cringe a little, and then I say, "No, Ted, it's okay. It's okay. You know, they're new. They'll get it. Actually, that's perfect. That challenged a little thing that you were grabbing onto there. So, yeah. Yes.
I'm new to this community. This is my first time being here, and I don't know a lot about them. But I want to say I really appreciate as a leader who is stepping in the leadership role, acknowledging that leadership and hierarchy is complex, both appreciating it and embracing it, and also acknowledging it that it exists and puts us in different roles. It was really beautiful for me to hear that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, this was expressing appreciation for acknowledging all of the complexities of leadership and hierarchy and sort of being willing to talk about that. So thank you for that comment. That was very nicely said. Yes.
I just wanted to say congratulations too, but I really appreciated that when we talked about that the decision to speak about it was because you were uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of move into something that made you uncomfortable as kind of your lesson or whatever. I don't know if I was understanding that or it was interesting. And even like the role of kind of the ego in not only, thinking about minimizing our faults, but also minimizing our gifts.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like you were kind of pushing through that.
Right. Minimizing our gifts, as in we can be sort of so humble and unassertive that we don't sort of do what we need to do. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I do like to go to uncomfortable subjects. I don't know if anybody remembers my gender dharma talk, but that was a tough one. I did a talk once about going way back to the 70s when I had such a difficult time during the war and as a protester and all my difficulties with that. And so I like to take a difficult subject and look at all sides of it. And that's what we do here. You know, we look at the difficult stuff. We look at the hard things in our lives. Sometimes we sit and things come up that are just really painful. But, you know, you need to deal with that stuff. You can't hide it away. And what better place to do it than here, where we have the support of each other. We have the support of teachers. It's a quiet, safe place. It's really a beautiful thing that we can come together and do that here. And I love you all, and I love this center. And let's turn this over to our esteemed Doan.